This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And today we're going to talk about a subject that is really making waves in the integrative medicine community. So much so that an exciting new summit is about to take place to discuss this subject. It is SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth. We first broached this subject here on Intelligent Medicine back in February of 2014. In fact, with today's guest, she's Dr. Allison Seebecker. She is the go-to person on SIBO, and she's the impetus behind a new SIBO summit, which is going to be a gathering of experts on the subject of small intestine bacterial overgrowth. She is a naturopathic physician, a licensed acupuncturist. She is trained also in oriental medicine, and she was the co-founder and former medical director of the SIBO Center for Digestive Health. Imagine that. There's a place devoted entirely to treatment of SIBO and has specialized in the treatment of SIBO since 2010, which is practically since the origin of this concept. So it's a pleasure having you back on Intelligent Medicine, Dr. Seebecker. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me back.
It's my pleasure. And so, well, first of all, you know, we'll talk about the summit in just a minute and, you know, who it's for. But what is SIBO?
It is like it sounds. It's when there's too many bacteria accumulated in the small intestine. And I guess the thing to know about that is that they're not supposed to be there. So we're familiar that we should have a lot of bacteria, and we do have a lot of bacteria in our large intestine. That's good. But they can accumulate in the small intestine, and then that's bad. And that's basically what the condition is.
It's kind of like backflow, because it's supposed to be... There's supposed to be bacteria. It's part of our microbiome in the large intestine, and they actually help to do a lot of things. They help to break down and digest food. They even synthesize nutrients. But due to various factors, there seems to be kind of a tendency for the bacteria to proliferate upstream where it doesn't belong. What sets people up for SIBO?
There can be so many things, and before I explain what all these things can be, it's good to know that, or not good, I guess it helps understanding to know that it's common. SIBO is common. And the only way that that would really make sense then is if there are a lot of different ways people could get set up to get this. So there's a wide range of diseases that can lead to SIBO. There are drugs or medicines that can lead to it. Also, there could be some genetic circumstances, and things like surgery and other lifestyle factors could lead to it. So we have a lot of ways it could come upon us. But I think the two key underlying ways this can occur is when the motility in the small intestine, the natural movement that's supposed to happen there when we're not eating, separate from our eating, when that doesn't work very well. And that's called the migrating motor complex. There's a special cleaning wave. It's called the cleansing wave that comes out after we eat to sweep the intestines free of certainly the leftover food or food debris, but most especially bacteria, because they would accumulate there if we didn't have movement to push them down. So that's probably one of the main underlying problems. And then I'd say two other of the main underlying problems are, if our anatomy is not normal, like just the normal way we're supposed to, you know, have a tube and it flows through and it goes from one area to the next. That's our small intestine. Well, things can impinge upon it and cause partial obstruction. And that's probably the second most common underlying cause. And then I'd say maybe the third would be if we have insufficient stomach acid, because stomach acid does kill incoming bacteria. And so one of the ways that can happen very commonly, meaning that it can go down, is that we could be on proton pump inhibitors, yep. Acid suppressing medicine. So common, you know, and that's a main risk factor for SIBO. We don't know if that in and of itself alone is enough to cause it. I've seen a few cases like that. I think very often it more just increases risk. And then if something goes wrong with the motility or the anatomy, we then for sure wind up, you know, having a problem. But let me just, before I leave the topic of causes, sure. Let me just mention the most, what we think the most common one is, because it's really interesting, and that would be food poisoning. So, you know, you go out to a restaurant and, gosh, something went wrong, and then you have vomiting and diarrhea. And that is also called traveler's diarrhea and stomach flu. So it's not just when you go to a restaurant, you know, you get a flu, you get a stomach bug, and that can cause it. And same with traveler's diarrhea, you know, like Montezuma's revenge in Mexico. So that is just fascinating to me. And this is where it really starts to make sense how common the condition can be, because food poisoning or stomach flu and traveler's diarrhea is so common. And the situation there is, that's caused by different bacteria. Food poisoning actually can be caused by viruses or bacteria, but in this case, the connection with SIBO, it's caused by pathogenic bacteria, where SIBO itself is not pathogenic bacteria. So what happens is the pathogenic bacteria trigger an autoimmune response in the person that has had food poisoning, in some people. And then the immune system damages our own small intestine nerves. And then what happens is we can't do that migrating motor complex very well. And so the movement slows down, it becomes stagnant, or sort of stasis occurs in the small intestine. And then the bacteria just back up, particularly the ones coming from the top down. And then we can have SIBO. So in that case, what's backing up is not the pathogenic bacteria. They've already infected us and been gotten rid of. And so now it could be sometime later. Could be weeks, could be months. Some people will have it right away.
It's sometimes referred to as post-infectious gastroenteritis. And I believe there's now even a test for it that was just recently developed.
Absolutely. In fact, so in this scenario, post-infectious IBS, it is SIBO. We have now discovered that they are one and the same thing, post-infectious IBS and SIBO. And that test is a screening test for basically for post-infectious IBS and SIBO. And it's a great test. It's when you test the toxin that the bacteria secrete and the nerve cell, the protein on the nerve cell, you check to see if the immune system has had a reaction against them. That's, you know, that's kind of just a brief overview of the causes, because there can be so many.
Well, is this in some ways a disease of modern civilization? Is it somehow due to our lifestyles, being sedentary, or being on a certain diet, the standard American diet, or could it even have could stress even have an impact on it?
Well, these are such good questions. I don't think it's primarily a factor of modern lifestyle, except in two ways, which would be the fact that we do travel so much and eat out so much, which may have increased the incidence of food poisoning and traveler's diarrhea in that way. And then you mentioned stress, and I do think it plays a part. I don't believe it's the main cause. I've only ever seen one case in many thousands where we can tell it was really just only caused by stress. But I don't want to belittle the way that stress plays into things, because I think it's very important. Specifically, so this would be chronic stress, which so many people have, being in a sort of a fight or flight state, a sympathetic dominant state, that turns off the migrating motor complex. So there you go. If you're just constantly in a state like that, we also know that that turns off your hydrochloric acid, your stomach acid secretion, and your secretion of enzymes. So digestion in general is impaired in many ways when we are constantly stressed. And I do believe we all are constantly stressed, most of us, you know.
It even creates a dry mouth, you know, lack of mucus secretions, which, you know, is where digestion starts.
So important. But back to your question, I think that this condition has been present for as long as humans have been present, and there are many ways to get it. There are many diseases that will make it happen. And so like diabetes, I believe diabetes mm-hmm. has been around as long as humans have been, you know, systemic sclerosis, hypothyroid, these things are age old and cause it. Mm-hmm. So it's not really just modern, but I think there's these factors we just mentioned might have been increasing it, you know. And also one other thing is that we do know all the pesticides and the improper modification of our foods, food sources, they are creating a weakness in the digestive tract. And certainly if you compare a strong person to a weak person in terms of their digestion and you give them both food poisoning, the weaker person is more likely to get it. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the resistance factors, the so-called terrain, may be even more important than the pathogens, because the pathogens act more virulently on certain people and others may be more resistant.
Yes.
So who should suspect that, I mean, now that people are hearing about this, who should suspect that they have SIBO and who should be potentially interested in the summit to learn more?
The people who would suspect it are those that have the main symptoms of SIBO, which are also the main symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome. And those symptoms are abdominal bloating, also called distension, when the stomach swells out, usually after meals, and usually worse at the end of the day.
Do I hear a lot of that in my office? Oh, my goodness. It's like, and the women hold out their bellies, and they say, well, you should see it. I'm examining them, and it's not that big now, but sometimes after I eat, it looks like I'm 5 months pregnant. I hear
that again. In fact, as SIBO doctors, we classify people's bloating based on how many months pregnant they report that they look. And this is the men too.
Yeah. Of course. But interestingly, there does seem to be a bit of a female predominance. And I'm not sure whether that's a hormonal thing or whether the men are maybe, I don't know, more stoical about feeling lousy and don't come to doctors with complaints unless their heads are falling off.
It's so true. But it does. It does seem to affect women a little bit more. As we know, IBS affects women a little bit more. So, yeah. And I do
maybe
think
because they have less in the way of hydrochloric acid and pancreatic enzymes. Generally, because men are bigger, have more muscle bulk, they have a more robust production of some of these digestive factors. And particularly as women age, sometimes that declines and then they cross a threshold after which they're not really properly digesting.
What a great point. Thank you for bringing that out. That might be one of the very reasons why we see it more in women.
Indeed.
So back to the symptoms. Then there's abdominal pain, or it could just be discomfort. It might not just be, pain. And then there's the bowel movement irregularity. So this could be diarrhea or constipation or a mixture of the two in whatever way that shows up. So those are the key main symptoms. However, SIBO also comes along with a bunch of other unpleasant symptoms, such as, first off, there's food reactions. And by this, I don't necessarily mean things like rash and,
not traditional nasal allergies. In other words, intolerance is not like allergic reactions. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, those can come too. But what I mean is actually the digestive symptoms. So people eat something and they get a digestive symptom like bloating or whatever it is. So that is extremely common, and fatigue. But then there can be also the other digestive symptoms like acid reflux or nausea. Gurgling and rumbling in the stomach, excessive burping or farting, things like that.
And also sometimes an acid splash or a sensation of regurgitation is associated with that from time to time?
Absolutely. Honestly, any digestive symptom, we've seen it with SIBO. We just have sort of the core ones. And I would say bloating, mm-hmm. Along with bowel movement irregularity, those are sort of the core mm-hmm. symptoms. And sometimes a person will have it without those. But there's one other scenario I wanted to mention where someone might want to think about SIBO, because it's an interesting one. Even if a person does not really have digestive symptoms, there are a lot of diseases or conditions that SIBO is associated with, and there's ways in which these can be associated, like maybe SIBO causes them, or maybe they cause SIBO, or maybe we just don't know, but they seem to come together frequently. For instance, like rosacea, mm-hmm. and so, or restless leg syndrome. So there's all these associated conditions where if a person has them and they have tried the standard treatment for them and that hasn't worked, then you might want to think about SIBO, because there are these studies done on, say, like restless legs and rosacea, where these people, they didn't really even have digestive symptoms, but they were tested, found to have SIBO. Then they treated the SIBO and the rosacea got better, you know, and they have really good statistics on this. And I think where this makes sense is, you know, the old saying that all disease begins in the gut, that sort of thing.
Hippocrates, so 450 BC, something like that.
There you go. Yeah. Exactly. So we can, you know, we can affect many other diseases and many other aspects and parts of the body when we clean up the digestion. So that would be the other reason a person would think about it.
Indeed, because it could be a clue to other systemic problems that, you know, may not be initially suspected to arise from the gut. So now, this upcoming summit, you've already touched on several points, and what it looks like is that you've got different specialists weighing in on different aspects of this. You're going to have some people talking specifically about the treatment, the diagnosis. Some people are going to talk about the relationship between thyroid and SIBO. I think there's an entire segment devoted to that. What else can listeners expect if they sign up for the summit?
Yeah, that's true. All of that. And expounding on that, we have a lot of people have SIBO and yeast overgrowth or candida. We have several speakers talking about that. So we're really trying to delve into the conditions that come with it and talk about how they exist together and what to do about that, as well as you said, just the core information on SIBO, what it is, how to handle it, what's treatment all about. So I cover the fundamentals, and then all the other speakers kind of go off into all these other wonderful areas and also give more detail. And so, like, some of the other conditions that are addressed are things like toxic mold that can go along with SIBO, or, you know, worsen the SIBO condition, Lyme and tick-borne illness, even sleep apnea, and a lot of the underlying causes for it, the things like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which maybe a lot of people haven't heard of, you know, but it's actually not even a rare condition.
Which definitely affects motility. That's a big issue in Ehlers-Danlos patients, but a condition that's really under-recognized and under-diagnosed, but can be very devastating.
Absolutely.
And it's sometimes hard to pick up by conventional medicine.
Exactly. We've got my sort of SIBO partner in crime, Dr. Sandberg Lewis. I shouldn't say in crime, in health, my SIBO partner in health. Dr. Sandberg Lewis, he was my gastroenterology professor. He taught, I think, about a third of the speakers we have on there. He's like a legend. And he goes quite into that and talks about the physical exam you can do for it, and demonstrates people how to do it right at home. Some of the exams, very important. So we really explain a lot of these sorts of things. And the other thing I like, a couple other things about it, is that people give their different treatment approaches and their opinions about, you know, what they think the best treatment is. And I personally like hearing all the different opinions. I know that sometimes people can feel overwhelmed by that or confused, but I love it, because what it shows me is, so long as you get your basics covered, like you're using some kind of a diet and you're using some kind of antimicrobial treatment, well, then within that, all the little details of how you apply it, when there's different differences of opinions, it shows me it doesn't matter that much. And that's hopeful. That's inspiring. It means get your core treatments in. You're good to go. Don't worry about all the details. Follow whatever your doctor's saying. It's all going to work, you know? So
many paths to salvation on this, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So, and then the other thing is that our host, Siobhan, she asked most of every speaker a couple of the same questions, and I thought that was fascinating. She asked everyone what they think about coffee, and then she asked everyone, like, how much water should we drink? And she also asked everyone, what if it's a really tough case or a person doesn't seem to be getting better? What should we be thinking about? What should we be doing?
And that's, you know, important, because it's not a quick fix. And in conventional medicine, it's recommended that you take a certain antibiotic. In fact, I actually believe that one of the reasons that SIBO has been recognized by conventional medicine, after so many years, you know, we were talking about candida and dysbiosis, and they just didn't pay attention. But when SIBO hit the mainstream, it was because they had developed a drug that was designed to treat it. It's a multi-million, perhaps billion-dollar drug that is intended to be a quick fix for IBS. Would that it delivered on that promise.
Yeah, you know, that that medicine is just a miracle. I almost wonder if it shouldn't even be called an antibiotic. It's now being called an antibiotic with eubiotic properties. It's so different from the properties are so different from a standard antibiotic that, you know, it can scare people to hear that it's an antibiotic, but it works so differently. And it's actually been shown to increase lactobacillus and bifidus in the large intestine. It is just so interesting, this medicine, you know? So, and that we're talking here about rifaximin. Yeah, brand name. I mean, the thing is
which can work in my experience. However, without some of the ancillary treatments, without diet, without certain botanicals, without the right kind of support, sometimes with probiotics, it's not invariably a quick fix, as beneficial as it can be.
Oh my God, you are so right. I mean, this condition is tricky. It's just not a quick moving situation, this condition. And absolutely, I mean, right from the get-go, Dr. Pimentel, one of our, you know, lead researchers and in SIBO, always would recommend this with diet. I mean, which is so fantastic. He's a gastroenterologist and has been recommending diet as part of this treatment all along. So you can see even the top in here, but who is, you know, traditional gastroenterologist, does not recommend Cefaxan without diet. And in fact, without follow-up with prokinetics, which can be natural or pharmaceutical. Great. So yeah, it's not quick.
We'll get into all that in part two. This is a good point at which to pause, because I think we've really beautifully laid the groundwork for our discussion in part two, which is how to diagnose SIBO properly, how to treat it. And we'll talk a little bit about an opportunity which I think many of you may want to take advantage of. It's a SIBO summit where you can learn a tremendous amount about how not just to treat SIBO, but about how to optimize your digestion and your microbiome. Our guest today, Dr. Allison Seebecker, and we're talking about small intestine bacterial overgrowth. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.